From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll talk with musicians Paul Burleson and DJ Fontana. Both played parts in the birth of rock and roll in the 1950s. Burleson is the guitarist with Johnny Burnett's rock and roll trio, and Fontana as Elvis Presley's drummer. They're still playing the rockabilly music they helped create in their current band, the Sun Rhythm Section. Also today, I'll speak with writer James Crumley. He's updated the detective genre and moved it west to Montana. Rhythm guitarist and singer Marty Gross will pay tribute to one of his favorite musicians, Fats Waller. And our critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews two comedies about black stereotypes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guests are guitarist Paul Burleson and drummer DJ Fontana. They call their six-member band the Sun Rhythm Section after Sun Records, the Memphis label that launched Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Roy Orbison. Paul Burleson is the founder of the band. In the mid-50s, he teamed up with Johnny and Dorsey Burnett in the Rock and Roll Trio, one of the first and some say one of the wildest of the rockabilly groups. Rockabilly was the fusion of country music and rhythm and blues that together formed the earliest southern-flavored rock and roll. Burleson is credited with inventing the fuzz guitar sound. When the rock and roll trio broke up in the late 50s, he retired from playing professionally and started an electrical contracting firm, a business he continues to operate between performances with the Sun Rhythm Section. DJ Fontana was the drummer for Elvis Presley from 1955 to 69. He's featured in many of Elvis Presley's most successful recordings and on the 1968 network TV special. He was also in Jailhouse Rock. When he left Presley's band, DJ Fontana became a studio drummer in Nashville. A little later, we're going to talk about the early parts of their careers, but first, to give you a sense of how the Sun Rhythm Section sounds today, here's Love My Baby. The Sun Rhythm Section from their forthcoming album, which will be released in July and will be called Old Time Rock and Roll. Welcome, Paul Burleson and DJ Fontana.
Oh, thank you very much.
Paul Burleson, you founded this band, the Sun Rhythm Section. You had been in musical retirement since around 1957. Why did you want to put this band together?
Well, the Sun Rhythm Section was actually put together by a guy named Jay Orr from the Smithsonian. From the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. He came to Memphis and wanted to get us together to go to the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. They never had a rockabilly group at the Smithsonian Institute, so Jay suggested it and asked if we could get it together and put it together. So we put it together, and the six of them consists of Sonny Burgess, Smoochie Smith, Stan Kessler, Marcus Fenstory, DJ, and myself.
You know what I'm thinking? You're two of the people who really helped create rock and roll, but most people who listened to rock and roll didn't know all the names of all the people in the band. So this is an opportunity, I would think, to really call the shots more than you might have been able to in rhythm sections.
Well, back in those earlier days, there was all the concern about the so-called star. They could care less about the musicians or anything else. Now they're doing it more so. You see names on the back of albums, Springsteen's albums, everybody's albums. You see more names.
DJ Fontana, you were doing studio work for years, and you're still doing it now.
I'm still doing the same thing.
Do you sometimes have to play things that your heart isn't in? Is this a refreshing break for you?
Well, yeah. Some of the producers get a little bit technical, which I think is unnecessary. They're getting too slick with some of their productions. I think if you get a little rough edge to it, if you get the feel of the record, I think they'll leave it alone.
What a great reunion this must be.
It really is, Terry. And we're certainly proud to be here in Philadelphia and to be on the show. We are really looking forward to the show out here, and hope it have a big crowd to turn out.
Well, I want to talk to each of you about the early parts of your career when you were basically helping to create what we now call rockabilly. Paul Burleson, let's start with the rock and roll trio that you played in. And before we talk about it, I want to play one of the songs that you recorded. Let's hear it. This is Train Kept a Rollin'.
I caught a train. I met a dame. She was a hefty and a real gone dame. She was pretty from New York City. And we trucked on down that old fair lane with a heave and a ho. Well, I just couldn't let her go. Get along, sweet little woman, get along. Better be up on your way to get along. Sweet little woman, get along. Better be up on your way to with a heave and a ho. Well, I just couldn't let her go. Well, the train kept a rolling up on that hill.
That guitar will give you a sense of how my guest Paul Burleson sounded in the mid-1950s when he was part of the rock and roll trio. Now, you started off playing country music and ended up playing rockabilly. What was the transition like? Do you remember things subtly changing in there?
Well, actually, we was going from country and a little blues and doing a little western swing music back in those days in the early 50s until Elvis came on the scene. And after that, well, everybody just kind of got on the bandwagon and started doing this that type stuff.
What did it mean for you in your guitar playing louder, faster?
Well, I had free choice. I could do anything I wanted to do. We didn't have any kind of arrangements, anything. So we just kind of tried to do anything that sounded different or come up with anything that had a pretty good sound to it. So if it sounded good, we just used it. And that particular song right there, well, I've been doing that thing for several weeks before we recorded it and liked that, and so everybody liked it, so we just used it.
You had a reputation for being a pretty wild band. What were some of the things you'd do on stage?
Oh, I would lay down on my back and play guitar, you know, get on my knees, you know, and stuff like this. I chewed gum all the time, you know, even on national television, I chewed gum and stuff like that, and I guess they thought it was a little wild back in those days. I guess it was.
Now, you got your start on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour when the band went to New York trying to make a name for itself. It ended up as, I think, 3-time winners on Ted Mack. Now, I remember that as this very sedate program with basically young vaudevillians, you know. What did you do on the show?
We just played rockabilly music. We did one of Chuck Berry's songs, Maybelline, first night, I think. Then we did another up-tempo type song. Then I think we did Blue Suede Shoes for the third week. And that was just rockabilly music. To us, it was just about all we was doing at that time.
That helped you get a recording contract.
With Coral.
When you were in the studio, I'm sure that a lot of the engineers and producers weren't really used to the kind of music you were playing.
No, they didn't know what to do with us. They had a 32-piece orchestra at our first session at New York City at the Python Temple. And the orchestra leader came over and told us, said, "Now, boys, we don't know anything about this rockabilly and rock and roll stuff. Said, you tell us what to do, and we'll be glad to do it, you know, background and everything." And we just laughed at them, you know, told them we didn't know what we was doing either. We just did what we felt like doing and played the way we felt. So they said, "Well, is there anything that you can use in the group?" So we used this drummer. And actually, he didn't even play on his drums. He played on his cases.
Really? Why did he do that?
Well, he was sitting down on the end of the stage, and I couldn't hear him, and I kept telling him to play louder. And he says, "If I play any louder, I'm going to break the heads on my drums." And I said, "Well, I still can't hear you." And so he said, "Well, I'll get my cases over here." So he brought his cases over there, and he played on the black plastic cases. And that's what you hear on Tear It Up. Yeah, his name was Eddie Grady.
Let you give us an idea of how loud you were all playing.
You're right.
So did you tell that 32-piece band basically to get lost, that you didn't need
them?
We
told the leader of the band that we didn't need any of the rest of them, so he dismissed everybody else, and so they all left.
You basically invented the fuzz guitar sound.
Well, I've been accused of it, but I dropped my amplifier. It happened as an accident, really. I was right here in this town. We was playing here in Philadelphia with the Four Aces and some more groups, and I was walking down the hallway, and the strap on my amplifier broke, and the amplifier fell to the floor. I picked it up, put it under my arm, carried it out on the stage, plugged it in, and didn't know that it, you know, what had happened, you know. So they introduced us, they opened the curtain, the announcer came out and introduced us. I started playing, it sounded fuzzy. And so Johnny looked around at me, and I looked back at him, and we just kind of smiled at each other, and I shrugged my shoulders. And after the thing was over, the show was over, then we went backstage, and I took the back off of it and looked to examine what had happened, looked at all the wires, and I thought maybe my speaker was busted, but it wasn't. What had happened, one of the tubes that dropped down was acting as a rheostat, like a dimmer in your dining room or something, so it was delaying the sound going through there. So I pushed the tube up, and it worked fine. And I forgot about it for several weeks later. We was at Nashville, and I told her, Owen Bradley at the barn where we recorded this album. And then we were just fixed to do a record, Train Kept Rolling. So that's why it's on Train Kept Rolling, the fuzz. And then we did Honey Hush right behind it. I pushed it back up in the amp, and that's the last time I ever pulled it down. Record.
What made you think that you liked the sound that was caused by a defect in the amplifier?
I didn't really predict, well, I liked it a little bit, but I didn't know that it was going to create a big stir or anything, you know, until engineers started calling me at the motels, asking me, what am I doing on this thing? Why are you getting that sound on this song? And so I just told them, you know, I told them what happened, you know, that it was, you know, just a loose tube. And the thing, a lot of people said that I couldn't. Took razor blades and split my speakers and stuff like this, but I never did splitting speakers. That's the only thing that ever happened.
What happened when you got a better amplifier and you couldn't loosen the tube? How were you able to recreate the sound?
I never did recreate it. I never did. After that, it was just a little Fender Deluxe amplifier and never could recreate the sound. But the little old amplifier, you could do it if you had a little Fender Deluxe amp. That's the only one you could do it on. And the third tube over from the back, looking at it, you had to wiggle it to get it just right. You couldn't just pull it down, the tube down. You had to kind of wiggle it to get it, make it sound fuzzy, till you hit the strings of the guitar to make it sound fuzzy.
I'm sure, a lot of great stories about how you met the Dorsey brothers. You were all boxers. You were, I think, the welterweight champion of Memphis when you met?
I was the open welterweight champion of Memphis when I met Dorsey. It was 1949. In January or February of 1949. And I was playing on a radio program there in KWEM, West Memphis, Arkansas. And I played an instrumental that day, and Dorsey heard me playing on the radio. And when he sat down beside me at the auditorium that night for the boxing matches, he said, "You're Paul Burleson." I said, "That's right." He said, "I'm Dorsey Burnett." We shook hands with boxing gloves on. He had his on, I had mine on. He was a novice welterweight. I was an open welterweight. And he said, my brother and I, we play music, said, well, let's get together sometime and pick some. And I said, okay. And he said he liked what he heard, and he said, I'd like for you to hear me and my brother play. And I said, let's get together. I said, okay. But it was a year or two later before we finally did get together.
I guess people didn't mess with you knowing you were all boxers.
Not too much.
They can clean the house.
the ones around Memphis didn't mess with us too much. Maybe on the road sometimes, you know, somebody might say something, but... We could take care of ourselves pretty good. I mean, but if somebody got on one, then of course you had to whoop all three of us, you know, but we did know how to take care of ourselves, but we didn't really go out starting trouble at all, really. We didn't go out and try to take advantage of it just because we knew how.
Why did the band split up?
When did it split up?
Why did it split up?
Well, Doris and Johnny, both of them were singers, and both of them had good voices, and they could both put on good shows. And Dorsey, he wanted to branch off on his own and become a singer, and he was tired of playing the bass, and so he branched off and went off on his own in the middle of 1956. And then in the fall of 1957, I got tired, just exhausted, and I was tired of being away from my family and missing my children, and so wasn't nothing really happening big, so I just quit.
Did you miss it a lot? Because you started your own electrical contracting company, different life than in rock and roll.
I missed it very much. And in fact, I had to get the guitar and amplifier out of my sight for a couple of years to really get it out of my system, you know. And so after that, then it was really hard on me because after I started, I was really having a rough time with the electric company to get it off the ground. And, you know, when you start a new business, it's really tough. It was for me. And it was real tough. And then right at that time, well, they was having hits right after the other, right at that time. Mm-hmm. Dorsey had Tall Oak Tree, a big hit. And then Johnny came out with Dreaming and You're 16. And I was struggling right at that time. And it was really hard because they was calling me all the time and asking me to, come on, man, come on back. You know, we'll cut you back in as a third just like you was, you know, and everything. Come on out here, California. You know, you don't need to be up there. And but I said I couldn't do it because I didn't have anything to do with that, you know. I said I didn't have anything to do with it, and I couldn't come out there because I feel like I was a handout or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I said I got to do something on my own. So I stayed at home and just dug in and really – I made my electric company a success, and I'm really glad I did now, because it's meant a lot to me.
You've got a great band now too.
I mean, it's one of the greatest bands that I love them, every one of them, and I think they're just great, every one of them.
I'm speaking with Paul Burleson, and he's a founder of the new Sun Rhythm Section band, and we're going to hear more of their music a little later. In a moment, I'll be back with Paul Burleson and DJ Fontana, who was Elvis Presley's drummer and is also in the Sun Rhythm Section, and we'll take a short break first. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are two musicians from the Sun Rhythm Section, guitarist Paul Burleson and drummer DJ Fontana. DJ Fontana, I want to talk with you now about your early days in rock and roll. You were Elvis Presley's drummer from about 55 to 69.
Yeah,
Before we talk about those days, I want to play one of the most famous recordings that you were featured on with Elvis Presley, and everyone's going to recognize this.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class.
That has to be one of the most famous drum rolls in history. Did you have that one planned?
No, not really. It's like Paul said, we didn't ever plan anything. We never knew what was going to happen from one second to the other. And we'd go in the studio, we'd kind of piddle around and find things, you know. And that just one of those things just accidentally happened. There was no reason for it. I decided to put it in there, and he said, hey, that's great. Do it every time, you know.
How did you meet Elvis Presley?
He'd come to the Hayride, Louisiana Hayride, down in Shreveport, Louisiana. I was working as a staff drummer. It was basically a country show, I mean, real country. So they had Webb Pierce, Farron Young, and these type people on the show, Johnny Horton. And they called me in, the manager did, from the Hayride, and said, we've got this kid coming in. I want you to listen to his record and see what you think. And I thought it was the greatest sound. I've never heard a sound like that. So we're going to bring him in for two or three shots, and they may want you to work for him. They may not. And I said, well, that's fine. So they come in, Elvis and Scotty and Bill. There was only three of them at the time. They said, would you mind working behind us this week, you know, just a couple songs? I said, yeah, but I said, let's go back and talk about it anyhow. And I wanted to hear what they were doing. Like I said, they had such a unique sound. And I got to think, I said, well, now if I get in there and just play a lot, it's going to clutter up what they're doing. So I just played the backbeat, just stayed out of their way completely, and let them do what they did best.
Yeah, but you played it really aggressively.
Yeah, well, I just basically laid back, though, and stayed out of their way, and no fills and nothing fancy. Because, you know, with the slap bass and the Echoplex guitars and Elvis's rhythm guitar, I'd have just been in the way.
I want to ask you about the Ed Sullivan appearance that you and Elvis Presley were on, I guess it was the TV premiere, national TV premiere of Elvis Presley. And we've all heard about how the camera people were told to just shoot him from the waist up.
They said that, but I didn't see any sense in it, and I don't think anybody...
What were you told behind the scenes about that?
They said it was vulgar, his gyrations, but he really didn't do anything. Not comparing to what they're doing now. He was a saint, you know. Press, you know, they'll write anything that people tell them, and then you got the churches behind you, so you had to just really kind of behave yourself, you know. But Elvis wouldn't have done anything to hurt anybody's feelings or the country or anything else, and he didn't think it was wrong. He really didn't think it was wrong.
Were you given any instructions about how to behave on that program?
Not the band, no. We just were there to play and do what we had to do.
You were one of the first groups to perform in front of a lot of screaming people. I think you had a lot of screamers long before the Beatles did.
Yeah, that was quite a few years back.
How did that affect you as a drummer? You must have had to play really loud.
No, not really. He always worked us tight. Everybody was right up against each other. It was hard to hear a lot of times. But I know one time we worked at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. There was about 45,000 people. And back in those days, that's a lot of people. And we really couldn't hear him do a thing. And he took his microphone and went way out to the gate, to the fence. And we were like in the middle of the arena on the 50-yard line. So we was probably 75, 100 foot from the fence. And we couldn't hear a thing. And he couldn't, I'm sure. We only had three little pieces. But we knew by his movements, his hands, his feet, legs, we knew exactly where he was. So we had to watch him awfully close to find out where he was all the time.
So some of those swiveling hips were probably cues
to
the band.
It was cues. When I was 15 years old, I was working strip acts down in Shreveport. So I learned to follow these people. So when he done all his moves, I learned to follow him because then I'd know where he was at.
What was it like for the band when Elvis Presley's repertoire started to switch from rockabilly to more pop, and there were more ballads, the Jordanaires came in? Was that hard for you as the drummer?
No, we played it the same. Just go in and play like you felt playing, whatever the song called for. Elvis had an idea of exactly what he wanted.
But it was less wild. Did you mind that? Did you mind when he was tamed?
Because he was doing better material. Better songs, singing better.
What were the rehearsals like? Would he lead the rehearsals?
There wasn't no rehearsals.
No rehearsals?
No. No. If we went into the studio record, we'd just do what we wanted to do. He had an idea in his mind. If he heard a song, we'd go in, he'd talk about it. He'd say, I'd like for this to feel like this. I want this here. He had a keen ear, commercial ear, though, I'm saying. He didn't go for the off-the-wall chords and things and stuff like that. He wanted very, very simple things.
He started becoming very famous when he was very young, and the individual members of the band were not nearly as well-known or as recognizable as he was. Did that cause a gap between the players and
No, prison? The reason for that, back in those days, that's the way it was done, except if you had a trio like Paul and the guys, you know. But we were like musicians, he was the leader, he was the boss, so we did what he never did. It was no boss-sideman relationship, but that's the way we felt about it. He was the star. We would compliment anything he could do. We'd try to help it out.
You appear in two of my personal favorite Elvis Presley moments. One is in Jailhouse Rock.
That was a good movie.
It was a great movie. Yeah.
I enjoyed doing that movie.
And also you were in that terrific 1968 network special.
Special,
that,
with the black suit.
Yeah, he's wearing all leather and denim, as I remember.
It was hot.
The costume was hot, or the studio was hot?
The costume, that suit looked like it weighed 100 pounds.
Oh.
It was black leather. I mean, he was...
It was tight.
I don't see how he didn't pass out, really. And, of course, with the lights and everything, made it hotter.
What was exciting about that special, though, is that it was a period when you thought, well, maybe he'd lost it musically. Maybe he was just going to be doing bland pop songs.
Well, he was worried about it. He was really, really concerned.
About how he'd...
How
what kind of reaction he'd get.
Go over, yeah, because he had been doing movies for 10 years. And when you do movies, people are played to applause and clap and, raise cane. That's part of the job. So he was a little concerned, and we went back to the dressing room. We was talking about it. He said, "What do you think?" I said, "Hey, go out there and do the same thing you've done for years and get the people on your side. He had a knack for doing that. He knew how to, as young as he was, even at, in his earlier days, he knew how to get the people on his side somehow or another. I said, go out and do the same thing you've been doing for 15 to 20 years. He said, you think it'll work? I said, why not? You know, we were just talking about it. He said, I'm a little worried about it.
He got involved in so many excesses, and I'm not just thinking about, you know, drugs and food and things like that, but also excesses in music, show business excesses, big orchestras, elaborate costumes.
Yeah, well, that's when he went to Vegas. You know, that's showbiz there. You know, I don't think he was real comfortable at it.
Did you leave him before that?
Yeah, I left him. They wanted us to go to Vegas, but I really didn't want to go. Scotty had a studio.
The guitarist.
The Jordanaires had about 40 sessions lined up that particular time, so it was hard for them to all get away. And I hadn't been in Nashville very long, so I said, well, I'm going to stay here. I had two boys to raise, like Paul. You know, we had families by then, so I said, I'm going to stay home and try to get in on the recording end of it. So that's what I did.
So you didn't want any part of the Vegas stuff?
No, I didn't. We had been to Vegas in 1957, I think, and I don't know, it's just another world out there. You know, we'd have had fun, I'm sure, you know, and I'm sorry I didn't go now, you know. But still, I had been doing that for 25 years, you know.
Paul Burleson and DJ Fontana, you were both probably pretty wild in your youth, I think that's fair to say.
No.
Oh, come on.
No.
No, you weren't?
People thought we were.
Really?
The press gave us all kind of names, but they were wrong. We had a job to do, you know, and we had to work hard to do it.
You know, because they thought, oh, the rockabilly, you know, people were gyrating and moving their hips. Now, I know we played a show in Boston one time. That was in 1956. They wouldn't even show us from the waist down. They told us, they wouldn't even show us from the waist down at all. They told us no wiggling at all. And we didn't even wiggle anyway, you know. We didn't gyrate and do a lot of stuff like that, you know. And but they just, the television station just told us when we was on the television station that no wiggling, and they wouldn't show us from the waist down.
Well, how do your performances now compare to your style of playing when you were?
They're mild compared to a lot of the rock groups, but we move around a little bit, and we get a little older, but we still got a little life left in us.
Yeah, we ain't dead yet.
Yeah, we sweat, we work hard.
I just want to ask you: a lot of younger rock and rollers have paid your music many tributes, and let me just ask you if you have any favorites among the records that have either quoted things from your records or tributed in any way.
I got a chance to talk to Bruce Springsteen, very good friend. He's a nice man. And his drummer, Max Weinberg. In fact, Max wrote a book, The Big Beat. And he had everybody in that thing. And I was one he chose
right.
to be in it. I was real thrilled about that.
We got a few seconds, Paul Burleson.
Yeah, I like Stray Cats real well, and I like the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I like Jimmy Vaughn and Steve Ray Vaughan. I like that style very well.
I want to thank you both for being here, and I wish you the best with your new band, the Sun Rhythm Section.
Thank you very much for having us.
My guests have been guitarist Paul Burleson and drummer DJ Fontana, and they play in the band the Sun Rhythm Section, composed of musicians who used to play on Sun Records. And their first record together will be released in July on the Flying Fish record label. It will be called Old Time Rock and Roll. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with poet Robert Bly, so I hope you can join us.
Hey baby, where you wanna go tonight? Hey, let's go stepping. We'll do it all upright. Put your high heels on, wear your tight blue jeans, and we'll go bopping deep silvery moon. Hey, let's do rocking deep silvery moon. Watch the sun guy to play.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I'll talk with writer James Crumley. For years, his hard-boiled detective novels have had a cult following. They've just been republished. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the movie Hollywood Shuffle and the play The Colored Museum. Both are comedies about black stereotypes. Rhythm guitarist and singer Marty Gross will play a couple of songs by the performer who's influenced him most, Fats Waller. And we'll have a news update from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Marty Gross is one of a handful of musicians who specializes in what is becoming a lost art, jazz rhythm guitar played on a hollow-bodied instrument. He most often plays and sings tunes from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. We invited him down to our Philadelphia studios from his home in Brooklyn, New York. He brought a couple of songs written by one of his inspirations, Fats Waller.
Mischief now, really am in love and how I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see you're the only one for me. I've told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance. No living up to every vow, I'm keeping out of mischief now, yeah. Mischief now, really am in love and how I'm through playing with fire. It's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see you're the only one for me, babe. I have told them all in advance, they can't break up our romance. No living, living up to every vow. I'm keeping out of mischief now, babe. I'm keeping out of mischief now, fat mama. I'm keeping out of mischief now.
That was Keeping Out of Mischief by Thomas Fats Waller, a man who lived an exuberant, exciting life, wrote hundreds of songs, and some of them, like that last one, were tinted with the feeling of remorse and contrition, like his other songs, Ain't Misbehavin' and Please Get Me Out of Jail. Apparently he spent some of his time paying for his high life in the 20s and early 30s by spending time in jail for not paying alimony. But his exuberance and his love of life and his composing talents come to life in a song like this next one called I'm Crazy About My Baby. Goes something like this.
I'm walking on air, 'cause I've left all my blue days behind. I've learned how to care, 'cause there's love, really love, on my mind. I'm the world's most happy creature. Tell me, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby.
My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher. He and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Parson, get that book out. Ready in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination. A perfect he and she. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Da di da 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 di do 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 do. My baby's crazy about me. Dance with a puzzle. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, ding dong, ding dong. Tingling, tingling, tingling. Bring long, ding dong. Wedding bells for baby and me. Zaddy, daddy, 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 zappa, 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 Gilbert Sullivan. I was so serious by when I polish up the handles on the big brass door. My baby's crazy about me. Creature, what can worry be? I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Cupid was the teacher. He and I agree. I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. Oh, Parson, get that book out. Steady in your hand. Keep a lookout, you can understand. We're an A1 combination of perfect. He and she, I'm crazy about my baby. My baby's crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me.
That was rhythm guitarist Marty Gross. His latest recording, Marty Gross Sings of Love and Other Matters, is distributed by Statiris Records. We'll hear more from Marty Gross over the summer. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Crumley. He's updated the detective genre and moved it out west to Montana, which is where Crumley lives. He grew up in South Texas. Crumley has developed a cult following for the tough yet sentimental characters in his detective novels. Until recently, his books have been hard to find, but in the last couple of years, three of his novels have been reprinted as part of the Vintage Contemporary Fiction series. The main character in two of them, Dancing Bear and The Wrong Case, is Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III, Milo to his friends. He's an ex-deputy sheriff turned private eye who's almost always drunk and broke as he waits to inherit the family fortune. I asked James Crumley why he started writing detective novels.
I like the notion of being able to deal in some kind of murky world where the morality is not too clearly delineated. And before there's some kind of sense of justice that you can reach at the end, it's usually an uncomfortable and certainly unsatisfying sense of justice, but it satisfies me.
There are certain conventions of the detective genre. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages for you as a writer to be writing within a genre?
I find more disadvantages than advantages. You know, with the detective having to always, always be upright and forthright and honest and stern and steadfast and all of those things. And I think I've tried in all of the books to use a detective that's flawed in many of the same ways that the villains are flawed. And I think he even says occasionally that if he hadn't have been a cop, that he would probably be, you know, been a criminal. I guess the only real advantage to writing in a genre is that you can play off the genre. It's like everybody knows the rules, and so that you can do pretty much whatever you want to, as long as you admit the rules, you can break them.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the beginning of The Wrong Case.
Okay, that's a sort of a tradition for the detective to sit around his office and describe it so that the people, so that the readers can get a sense of him. And this is Milton Chester Milo Dragovich is the third. This is his office. The large old-fashioned safe in the corner left from my grandfather's days as a banker was empty except for $2,000 of untaxed mad money. Age and sorrow, those were my only assets, my largest liabilities. But like most men who drank too much, I'd spent most of my life considering my dismal future, and it had stopped amusing me. So I had another drink and walked over to the north windows to look down upon the happy, employed folk of Merriweather. Once we Milo Dragoviches had been big stuff in this town, but now the only way I could look down on anybody was to climb up to my office, stare down from the windows. Lunch hour was done. People were hurrying about their business, driving back to office and store in air-conditioned cars, even though the air seemed more like spring than summer. I'd never owned an air-conditioned car, so I could feel vaguely smug, until August, anyway.
Now, usually in detective novels, the characters' names are pretty short and simple. Philip Marlowe, Lou Archer. Why did you do a Milo Dragovich for your detective?
It was a name that I'd run across. It's an old Montana name. And it's just stuck in my head. I couldn't get rid of it. And I think the newer detective novelists are getting away from the one syllable easy names or the two syllable names that have some sort of symbolic background to them. I just like the sound of the name. And Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III.
Your detective says that he realized if he wasn't a cop, he'd probably be a crook. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a writer who spends a lot of time at a desk, probably behind a typewriter, or at least with a pad on your lap. Do you feel at all drawn to that world of crooks and cops?
Well, yes. In some kinds of ways, too, I'm a child of the 60s when everybody was a criminal, partially because of the marijuana laws and partially because of the politics in the protests. I know a lot of minor league criminals, I guess you could call them, and I have friends with several cops and ex-cops, and even know a few private detectives. So I find that world much more interesting, for instance, say, than the academic world where I labored for 11 years at various universities all across the country. I think all writers feel in some kind of way outside of the mainstream of the worlds they live in. And I think most writers find themselves drawn to other people who are on the outside looking in. So I'm not sure whether it's a fascination with crime or whether it's a fascination with alienation.
I wonder if it's a fascination with language also. Because both cops and criminals tend to have their own languages.
Mm-hmm.
Their own slang.
I have to admit, I got into writing because I like the way words sound. And that was the first thing that moved me when I first started writing when I was very young. It was a long time before I did it seriously, but just the way the words sound has always... I started off as a poet. They suggested that I try prose. and I get some of the best advice I'd ever gotten.
How did you discover detective fiction?
underneath one of my aunt's mattresses when I was about when I was about 9 years old. And the
was it supposed to be dirty?
Well, it was Mickey Spillane, and among It was pretty racy stuff for high school girls back then. I was still in grade school, and my aunts must have hid them for some reason. And so I read Mickey Spillane at an early age. And it wasn't until I was in the middle of my first novel that I went back to detective novels. A poet here in Montana, Richard Hugo, turned me on to Raymond Chandler. And I spent a summer working on my first novel in Mexico and reading all of Raymond Chandler's work, which is when I decided that I wanted to do at least one detective novel.
You grew up in Texas, and you now live in Montana. So you've spent most of your life in the West. Did you grow up with a lot of cowboy stories, Westerns, things like that?
My great-grandfather was still alive when I was a little boy right after World War II, and he was one of the last of the Texas trail drivers and wagon train drivers to die. And so I picked up a lot of stories from him. My father worked in the oil field, however, and I grew up in company houses. And I read probably as much Western fiction when I was young as I did anything else except for science fiction. And I also went to the Western movies every Saturday while my mother was at the grocery store, go to a double feature at the It Theater in Mathis, Texas. And so I got all that cowboy stuff pretty good.
Any connection, you think, between that and your interest in detectives?
I'm certain there is. In some kinds of ways, I'm not sure whether it's the Western novels are like detective novels set in the West or whether detective novels are like Westerns. But there has to be some sort of connection between the gunfighter and the detective.
Your novels are just republished now in the Vintage Contemporary series. And I wonder if you think you're being rediscovered by new readers or publishers?
I don't remember being discovered the first time, so it's difficult to be rediscovered. It's nice to get to a broader kind of audience than people who go looking for my books. And I think they've given me a little more clout in the literary world, if one needs clout in the literary world, to be in this series with the writers who are considered serious writers, Tom McGuane, Ray Carver, etc. But sometimes I wish I was in the smaller paperback editions and more widely distributed in truck stops and supermarkets and 7-Elevens.
With nice lurid covers?
Absolutely. I think that's where my audience. I think that's where my audience is. One of the things that has always encouraged me and made me feel good about the books that I write is that working class people read them and are moved by them. My background is firmly rooted in the lower middle classes, working classes, and I still remember what work was like, although I'm certainly glad I don't have to do it anymore. I do have a great deal of respect for those people. And when they like my books, I'm particularly tickled.
James Crumley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
James Crumley is the author of The Last Good Kiss, Dancing Bear, The Wrong Case, and When to Count Cadence. He spoke to us from station KUFM in Missoula, Montana. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
This is a big Supreme Court story today. Justice Lewis Powell Jr. announced his resignation.
Yes, he did, and we'll have two reports. First, a look at Justice Powell's career on the bench. He was a moderate, but his opinion has made enormous difference in recent years because he was generally the swing vote on a court divided between liberals and conservatives. And we also speak to an analyst from the Heritage Foundation who explains to us what conservatives want in President Reagan's next Supreme Court appointment.
Any entertainment tips for us for the weekend?
Well, Terry, as a matter of fact, we do. We have a review of Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick's first movie in 7 years. It's about Vietnam, and our reviewer says it's a knockout.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Generally, blacks have been portrayed in American popular culture through a variety of stereotypes, from shoeshine boy to maid to jive-talking street hustler and the wise but long-suffering matriarch who holds her family together. And this is generally done for consumption by white audiences. Recently, two young black writers have taken matters into their own hands. Our critic-at-large, Laurie Stone, has these thoughts.
Driving Miss Daisy, a play by Alfred Uhry, is currently running in New York. It's gotten great reviews, and the stars, Morgan Freeman and Dana Ivey, deserve them. But Driving Miss Daisy made me uneasy. It takes place in Atlanta between 1948 and 1973. Ivey plays Miss Daisy, a wealthy Jewish matron, whose character is established in the first minutes. She's lonely, stubborn, and she's sure black servants steal. Freeman plays Hoke, her new black chauffeur. He's presented as an unknown quantity, simply a man who needs a job. In a series of delicately drawn scenes, Miss Daisy comes to recognize Hoke's loyalty, cunning, fortitude, and intelligence. She is enriched, and presumably the audience's eyes are open, too. But who is this audience? They're not black. The wise, patient black figure, who humanizes whites and gets little spiritual food in return, is hardly someone black people need to discover. Two young black writers are offering audiences a crackling alternative to Miss Daisy's tired point of view. They are George Wolfe, author of the play The Colored Museum, which is a hit at New York's Public Theater, and Robert Townsend, the writer, director, producer, and star of the popular movie Hollywood Shuffle. Traditionally, black writers have felt a double pressure to explain blacks to whites and also please black audiences by showing the race in a flattering light. Artists in every minority group have struggled with similar demands, but for the good of their art, they've learned to ignore them. Wolfe and Townsend, who've done just that, are equal opportunity satirists, going after black and white manners with the same uninhibited glee. They address blacks, but whites are meant to overhear. And both artists use sketch formats. They hark back to minstrel shows in vaudeville, the roots of black entertainment, while transforming them. In Hairpiece, one of the sharpest bits in the Colored Museum, two wigs argue while a middle-class black woman prepares to dump her boyfriend. The bitch is bald, spits an Afro wig. Every time he changed his ideology, she changed her hair. When the Afro wig turns on a Diana Ross mane for being unnatural, she is slapped down. Don't you go telling me you from a real place, Miss Made in Taiwan. Pious chest-beating plays such as A Raisin in the Sun are hilariously lampooned in one sketch, and in another, about a black yuppie who tries to jettison his jive past, the boy in him screeches, "You can't throw away that Jackson 5 album. It's living proof Michael had a black nose." Hollywood Shuffle, which chronicles a black actor, focuses on the frustrations of playing parts made up by whites, just like Hoke in Miss Daisy. At the center of the film is a brilliant sequence called Sneaking into the Movies, where two black hustlers preview and bicker about upcoming features. One claims that a 400-foot Indiana Jones-type leap is believable because the man braced himself. When his friend objects, he's told, "What do you know about science? You dropped out of high school." The sketch at once dispatches Siskel and Ebert and every street-corner philosopher. It also retrieves the comic power of Amos and Andy. Townsend's characters are imagined from the inside, and the fact that they're created out of lived experience rather than someone else's fantasy makes all the difference between debasement and exhilaration, not to mention art and contrivance. Bravo to this insouciant breed of black artists.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with Village Voice columnist Pete Hamill. He recently returned to New York after a short stint editing one of Mexico City's largest papers. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review a compact disc featuring British violinist Nigel Kennedy. And TV critic David Bianculli will preview the new British miniseries, The Life and Loves of a She-Devil. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write to us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.